the Andy Caldwell Radio Show. Andy is a government watchdog, business and traditional values advocate, and on this show, he interviews leaders and scholars on a variety of local, state, and national issues.
I'd like to welcome you back to the show. Somebody who I've quoted more times than he could ever imagine is Ed Ring. He is a contributing editor and senior fellow with the California Policy Center, which he co-founded in 2013, and he served as its first president. He's also a regular contributor to the California Globe, run by our beloved Katie Grimes. His work's been published all across the land. He's got an undergraduate degree in poli-sci from UC Davis and an MBA from USC. And he's the author of two books, Fixing California and The Abundance Choice. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy. It's good to be back.
Well, thank you. Glad to have you back. And I'll tell you, one of the things I've always quoted ever since you shared this with me years ago was the title of your book, Abundance Choice, that instead of folks, what the control group wants us to do is fight over scarcity, rationing and scarcity versus creating abundance, which is the anti-Malthusian way to live. Malthus, you know, thought, hey, you know, the planet's overpopulated. We're all going to die. We've got to control population. We've got to control resources. They're dwindling. And technology has proved him wrong for several centuries now ongoing. And you just wrote about kind of this principle in terms of how we could have perpetual water abundance. Please share it with us.
Well, that's right. The whole mentality has to change. And, you know, we're actually even hearing sort of lip service for that, at the very least, from Governor Newsom. He's been bringing up the abundance concept lately, and it's about time that at least we're hearing that concept from everybody. When it comes to water in California, we built a miraculous system of interbasin water transfers back in the, you know, it started really 100 years ago. It really took off in the 50s and 60s. But by the mid 70s, we were pretty much done, both with the Central Valley Project, which was paid for by the federal government, and the California Water Project, which was a state effort. All of the reservoirs that we rely on, all of the aqueducts that we rely on to get water from the wet parts of the state to the dry urbanized parts of the state and to our farmers, of course, are using infrastructure that was constructed over 50 years ago, if not a century ago. And it's not a matter of, you know, sitting back and saying, well, we're having drier summers, so we're just going to have to ration water. That's not true. But what we do have to do is build new infrastructure for the 21st century that's going to allow us to deliver enough water to supply our farmers and supply our cities without having to ration water. And that's very doable.
So one of the things that's gone on is that instead of, and this is happening in energy, the same thing's happening in energy, that instead of using an all of the above approach and as many different eggs in the basket as possible. For instance, with energy, they want us to go to renewable only. Well, with water, it's conservation, 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 which translated as ration, ration, ration. So like in your piece, you talk about dams, reservoirs, conservation, desal, recycle, reclaim. It's an all of the above approach.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, there was an earlier article where I attempted to summarize what our all of the above approach options are with energy in California, because one of the biggest arguments against water abundance by environmentalists is, well, in order to do that, you have to filter water, you have to pump water, and you're going to use energy, and we don't have enough energy. So you have to address the energy challenge at the same time as you address the water challenge. And in both cases, the only way we're going to get there is with an all of the above strategy.
Well, I'll tell you what I suggested years ago, and of course this fell on deaf ears because government in California, and you know this better than me, is more about creating problems than solving problems. So Santa Barbara, for instance, had a desal plant back in the 90s. They mothballed it. They had to build it, renew it, and everything else. And of course, the energy costs are a big cost to desal. Well, at the same time, there was an oil company off of our shores, Venoco, that wanted to go into an adjacent lease from which they were in. And I made the suggestion, let them go into that lease, but make them supply all the natural gas you need to run the desal plant. So we've got literally more natural gas than we know what to do with. The environmentalists want us to keep it in the ground, but it burns clean. And they don't have to wire energy. They just have to pipe it energy it from the ocean floor. And what frustrates the heck out of me, and I heard Victor Davis Hanson talk about this years ago, that Pat Brown was one of these guys that was a builder and a doer. They would have just been dumbstruck to see these people step over a dollar to pick up a penny, a dollar's worth of energy, a dollar's worth of water to pick up a penny.
You know, I don't think that most people would recognize the Pat Brown Democrats today, and it would be mutual. I think the Pat Brown Democrats would look at 21st century Democrats in California and they'd just be appalled. Yes. By what they've become. You're right. These were practical politicians that saw a problem and saw the most efficient practical solution. And they implemented those, and they did it fast. You know, they built these things in 5 to 10 years, things that nowadays you wait for decades just to get approval. It's a very difficult process to build anything in California. And you're also right about energy. I mean, California's reserves of gas and oil are tremendous. There's plenty. We're the fifth largest oil producer in the United States. We used to be number three, right behind Texas and Alaska. But we've, of course, the fracking revolution never came to California. And at the same time, we've been closing things down. We've also made it impossible to develop additional refinery capacity in California. And they're talking about shutting down Diablo Canyon, which with upgrades, they say that the experts who study Diablo Canyon's design, it was designed to last until 2060. And why did they shut down San Onofre? It's rife with contradictions. When you talk about energy in California, you got to ask yourself why the people who are so concerned about climate change, and I know you've heard this before, we're all befuddled by it. Why are they against nuclear power? Nuclear power is getting safer all the time. And it is a big part of any solution that we're going to have. And it's one that they ought to be urgently supporting. If you look at what it's going to take for California to electrify their industrial, transportation, residential sectors, it's almost unthinkable that you can do it without much more than just renewables, because we would need to double the amount of energy we produce in terms of electrical energy. We, on average, use about 50 gigawatts. It's actually 57 gigawatts is the average over the last few years. That's the average amount of draw on California's grid. And if you were going to convert the transportation sector, industrial, residential, commercial as well, you'd need over 100 gigawatts. Where are you going to go get another 50 gigawatts of power generating capacity if you don't have nuclear and if you don't have natural gas? It's nuts to think that that's possible any other way.
Well, and the other point you made, we're going to take a break here, but the other point you made is, you know, California Environmental Quality Act, the Coastal Commission, Endangered Species Act, all the rest. In Israel, which is dependent on desal, Their desal projects cost one fifth of what they do in California. And one of the things that we've learned is, I've been a government watchdog for 30 years. It's not even the time and the cost of getting through the regulatory gauntlet. It's the fact that there's no certainty that even if you get through it, that you're going to get your permit built. It's a dice roll. It's a dice roll to do business in California. And, one of the clearest ones is Andy Puzder, who I know used to run the Carl's Jr. He left, he said, when he was still running it, he said, we're not going to build any more Carl's Jr.'s in California. It's not the worth the time, the hassle, and the money, and the uncertainty at the end. I remember, Santa Barbara County killed a Jack in the Box by not allowing it to have a drive-through. So technically, they approved the Jack in the Box, but they killed the one thing that helps make it profitable. And not only that, one year, a long time ago, they killed a Ronald McDonald's Kids Camp for cancer. Yeah. This is how low they've gone in this county by limiting the number of days it could operate. So they couldn't get sued because they technically approved it, but they killed it with the condition.
Right.
And they do this. This is business as usual in California. Hmm. And folks, it's why our energy costs are so high across the board. Ed, we're going to be right back. Ed Ring is with us. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show.
Right place. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show.
I'd like to welcome you back to the show. My guest is Ed Ring. He's a contributing editor and senior fellow with the California Policy Center. And he's also been writing for the California Globe, is the domain of our beloved Katie Grimes, who's with us every Wednesday afternoon. I'll tell you, I got tear stains on this piece. I ran for Congress 2 years ago. I'm always been a forthright guy. So the guy I ran against, Luke Carball, is a career politician. He was a county supervisor for a number of years. And then he, got handed to him the congressional seat by the Democratic Party in this region. So on the surface, I would say emphatically that Salute Carbajal would not need to, quote unquote, cheat to beat me, because the numbers are all there, plus the power of incumbency and all the rest. However, I got more votes than any other Republican ever in our district, and I still got creamed, and I got as many votes as he usually gets. But for lo and behold, somehow he got an extra 40 or 50,000 votes, which defies logic, because his bank was UCSB and Isla Vista, and they were gone because of COVID. And that's why we thought we were going to beat him and catch him, because Isla Vista's not there to save his neck. And yet he came in with record numbers. So my wife did the math, and he got nearly 100% of all the record turnout votes, i.e. over and above the normal. And people said, how is that possible? Well, we read your piece and it all made sense.
In that piece, I am careful to suggest that this is mere speculation.
Right.
Because we don't know exactly. I'm sure it could be learned. I'm sure a good investigative reporter could get in and uncover examples of how vote harvesting operations work and how same day registration operations work, which is even, you can be right at the end of a campaign and it's possible to already, through public access, you can legitimately determine what the turnout has been in your district by party. And if the turnout for your party is inadequate and there's a chance your candidate isn't going to win, you can actually go out in the final week, even in the last day, even on election day up until 8 p.m., and you can target households or college campuses, for example, that have eligible voters there that haven't registered. And you can register those voters and bring them to the polls and get them a ballot. We saw that, you know, on television in Nevada. It was, I think, the reason that Laxalt lost in Nevada. There were lines stretching out into the street from voting centers all over Las Vegas on election day. It's legal, I think, in 19 states. It might be a few more than that now, but it's definitely legal in California and in Nevada to have same-day registration. And, you know, any good political operative with some resources is going to have a database of eligible voters that's cross-referenced with consumer information that you can purchase from apps that go on cell phones or from credit card companies and other private sources. And you can develop a profile for every single eligible voter. You'll find attributes about them to give you a very good predictive idea of what their political sentiments are. And you can go find the ones that are most likely to vote for your candidate, and you can harvest their ballots. And if they're not registered, you can register them right up until 8 p.m. on election day and give them a provisional ballot. And that kind of an operation takes a lot of money and sophistication. But in California, there are perennial institutions that have that money and sophistication, primarily the public sector unions, but also huge private armies of nonprofit activists. And you have to understand that ballot harvesting, any get out the vote effort, if you do it right, isn't even considered explicitly political campaign spending. So you can have billionaires that get tax deductions to basically hire private armies of activists. And that's a reality as well as the financial power of the public sector unions. They're
Zuck Bucks. Mark Zuckerberg, folks, put in, what was it, $400 million?
Yes, it was
$400 million nationally. Mm-hmm. And then the union. So, Ed, when we first started CoLab, CoLab stands for the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business. When we first started this organization, it was in the recession of the early 90s, and there was 40% unemployment among the trades. So the trades wanted to join with manufacturing and industry and developers and energy sector to bring back our economy. So they were in, you know, we were in bed together, so to speak. Well, they taught me all sorts of things, including how they worked campaigns. You know, right. It never shows up on any campaign contribution form that unions went canvassing, that unions before cell phones, that unions canvassed, that unions did call banking and all the rest of the things that they did. It doesn't show up, and they literally would move this army to wherever they needed. And the same thing with college students, as you mentioned. What would happen when UCSB, to get UCSB's vote and Isla Vista's vote, they would literally bring busloads of college students and union workers from Los Angeles to descend upon the campus.
Sure.
You know, and then the other thing they did, and there, a student actually wrote a paper about this, the mastermind that created the Democratic political machine in Santa Barbara County created this program by which they were present in every single dorm initiation meeting to register those students as they registered for their dorms and have their first dorm meetings. So they have a machine. We're the Republicans, unfortunately, in our region, nothing, a ginormous nothing burger.
Everything you're describing has gotten more sophisticated and better funded. You know, the entrance of the tech zillionaires has added yet another powerful faction to that coalition. And sadly, I guess it's sad. It's good in a way, I suppose. But, you know, most of the trade unions, you know, the guys that do real work, they're all employed. They've got, you know, the high speed rail, for example, is employing tens of thousands of these, you know, very productive workers. They don't need jobs right now. They've got jobs. They've got full employment. So you're getting into a whole new area. But, you know, when you talk about trying to build water infrastructure, for example, you're running up against a new problem, which is the fact that the labor unions already have employment for their members. So they're not necessarily going to, for example, take on the environmentalist community and scrap high-speed rail just so they can build another dam or build a desalination plant, because they would have to declare war on their allies in order to do that. Whereas if they build high-speed rail, it's a non-controversial project that doesn't fracture their coalition. So a lot of things have changed in California in the last 30 years, you know, since you started that in the 1990s.
Yeah, well, they fell out, right? Those hardcore unions fell out right when the recession was over. So they were only with us for a little while. But I'll tell you, this issue of how they have, and again, folks, everything we're saying here is technically not illegal. It should be, but it's not. And that's one of the reasons the machine politics continues its path of destruction in the state of California. Ed, I want to thank you for everything you do. And you've had a great career as an analyst and a communicator that's unparalleled. Thank you for being with us. And I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving. And we'd love to have you on more often. I always want Charlie to get you on. So whenever you're available, you got something, just send it to Charlie and we'll book you.
I appreciate that. It's great to be back. And thank you for the kind words, Andy, anytime.
All right. Say hi to Katie Grimes for me.
I sure will.
All right. We're going to be back with Mike Brown. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show. Stay tuned.